Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 162. My name is Terry Frost, and this time we're hitting a couple of big movies. The first one is the 1955 drama, I suppose, Rebel Without a Cause, starring James Dean, Natalie Wood, and Sal Mineo. And then we go on to Paranoia with The Parallax View from 1974, starring Warren Beatty, Paul Apprentice, and William Daniels. So sit back, relax, and we'll get the show underway. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Hey, so how's everybody doing? Next weekend's going to be a big one for us, and the weekend after that, and the weekend after that as well. Next weekend, Sally and I are attending Continuum 11, the local science fiction convention here in Melbourne. Sal's going to be selling some of her jewellery, and I'm going to be on 4 panels and just basically shooting the shit with a lot of people and having a good time for the whole of the long weekend, which I'm looking forward to. I haven't been to a convention for a year because this is pretty much the one I go to. And I'm going to enjoy the hell out of it. It'll be good to catch up with people, including some of my Patreon supporters and subscribers, which is always a nice thing to thank them personally. And so that's on. And then the following weekend, we fly off to Sydney, and the following Monday, we fly from Sydney to Perth, all the way across the country. What I was thinking of doing, and I don't know whether this is going to come out or not, but there's a lot of time between Sydney and Perth. It's about 4 hours, and I've got a portable microphone, my new toy, my little portable microphone. I was just wondering whether I can get out a podcast while flying 10,000 kilometres in the air across Australia. I don't know whether it's ever been done, but I thought I might give it a go. What's the harm? I mean, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. If the noise levels are too high, then I won't put it out. But I'm going to give it a go, I think. I'll just have that as a kind of cool thing to do. Whether it disturbs the other passengers or not, who the fuck knows? But one way or the other, I thought I would try that, which is not, you know, it's going to be stunt podcasting in that sense. But I thought I'd give it a bit of a go. And test out the mic as well. I can always knock down the noise levels in the background. There are ways of doing that with the software that I've got to put down the aeroplane engine noise a little bit, as long as it doesn't flatten the sound of my voice any more than I already do. But having said that, I'm going to give it a go. If I don't, I may record a little bit in Perth. We'll have the portable recorder, and I'm bringing the laptop along. If I get a little downtime in Perth, the other thing I'm going to be doing is editing the audio from the Martian Drive-In podcast that I'll be recording live at Continuum. That's a 2-hour session that Grant, Sonia, and I have to just chat about movies and things like that in front of a live audience. They do have really nice microphones there too, and they've got those 3-pronged XLR outputs for me to put everything in, so I'm taking the mixer along and I'm going to do that. And as long as the technology doesn't fall on its ass, we should have a nice little podcast happening there as well. The movies this time around I find very interesting anyway. First off, I'm doing Rebel Without a Cause, the Nicholas Ray movie starring James Dean, Natalie Wood, Sal Mineo, Jim Backus, Dennis Hopper, and a bunch of other people as well, which is came at it from a different viewpoint than when I first watched it. Movies and our perception of them change as we age, and I've got a couple of things to say about this movie, which I didn't really pick up on previous viewings, but I'll leave that to when I talk about it. And the other movie is a conspiracy theory thriller from 1974, starring Warren Beatty, called The Parallax View, which I've wanted to do on the podcast for a while. I think it's a mindfuck of a movie, and I like it, and I like the way it's filmed. But so that's it. I don't think they have a common theme particularly, but there you go. They're two good movies, two American movies from the kind of middle chunk of the 20th century. And if you haven't seen either of them, or if you haven't seen either of them in a long time, I highly recommend that you do so. But anyway, as usual, I'm going to talk about the movies that I have been watching. And it took a moment or two to bring up my Letterboxd, but I've now got it on there. So here we go. What have I watched? I watched Spaceballs because I saw a Audience with Mel Brooks. It was on Netflix or somewhere like that, where Mel Brooks, now in his 80s or 90s, he's older than Oxygen, did a live Q&A in a stage show, a little bit of a monologue. So I thought I'd watch Spaceballs again. I haven't finished watching it. I will finish watching it at some stage. But, yeah, it's not Mel Brooks at his best, but people who like Star Wars seem to like it. So we had it on Blu-ray for that reason and haven't finished it. But I did see a James Coburn movie from the 1960s called Dead Heat on a Merry-Go-Round, which people know for one thing and probably not the best thing, and that is that it's Harrison Ford's first acting role where he plays a bellboy. And to be honest with you, doesn't do it particularly well. He's got the charisma of cardboard in that one. But it's a heist movie with James Coburn and Camilla Sparve, and a whole bunch of character actors going there. It's got a nice little twist in the ending, which you can't really predict, and it's kind of an ironic twist. It's got people in it like Seven Darden, and it's not a bad little flick. I like the music in it too. I forget who the music's by, but I do like the music on Dead Heat on a Merry-Go-Round, which is also a very good title. I really like that as a title for a movie. I did see a movie which is 30 minutes long, and it was crowdfunded, and it's called Kung Fu Fury, and it's a pastiche of 1980s action films, which was done in Sweden, and it's killer crazy. It's got Hitler, it's got dinosaurs. It reminds me a little bit of the Australian TV series which came out of South Australia, Danger 5. It's got a little bit of a Danger 5 thing, but with more of a 1980s action theme to it, and it's mad. That's all you can say about it, is it's fucking insane. And if you haven't seen Kung Fury yet, you should see it just for the fun of it. It's joyously stupid. So I enjoyed that. I knew nothing about it, and I downloaded it, and wow, pretty impressive. Now, for the radio gig, it was my last week with Rebecca McLaren doing the radio talks that I normally do with ABC Local Radio in the Northern Territory. And we decided, because it's like the 60th anniversary or 70th anniversary of the first Goon show, we'd do a Peter Sellers movie. And I picked The Party because that's the one that people tend to go to as a Peter Sellers movie. We talked about the brown face problem and where he's playing an Indian character. And my spin on that was that the character didn't have to be an Indian. I'm not talking about Cochise kind of Indians. I'm talking about subcontinental Indians. The character didn't have to be Indian to make this thing work. It could have just as easily have been a kind of nice and clumsy English actor. But Peter Sellers chose to do it in brownface, and it's a Blake Edwards movie. And I love the escalation of the chaos. It's not one of the best movies around, but people have a fondness for it. I put up on Facebook that I was going to be watching it for the radio, and everybody quoted the Birdie Num Nums thing about it and really enjoyed themselves doing that. But, it's one of those things where not every movie is fantastic that I do for the radio gig. I sometimes pick them at random and then go, oh, shit, why did I pick that? But that's part of the fun of the gig. I did see an Austrian movie, an Austrian horror movie set up in the, it's actually filmed in the Italian Tyrol, and it's called Blood Glacier, which is about global warming is, of course, melting glaciers all over the place. And an Austrian team are up in the mountains exploring and studying glaciers. And they find one that turns bright red, and they find a microorganism in it, which has the horrible ability to merge the DNA of two different species. So if you ate some chicken and then get infected with this microorganism, it will cause you to develop tumors, which will give birth to a human-chicken hybrid. That doesn't actually happen in the movie, but I was just using that as an example. Now, a lot of this stuff is done with some high-quality puppetry, so you don't get very clear views of all of the monsters. But it's a nice little horror movie anyway. It's a little bit different. It shows a really creepy kind of apocalypse, the start of a really creepy kind of apocalypse. And it has some unusual characters in it, too. There's a female middle-aged woman politician in there, not unlike Angela Merkel. And, really is, it's not fantastically great, but I like the fact that it's a little bit different. It's trying to do something a bit different. And it's got some very lovely locations. So there's that as well. The other thing I saw was I went to a, secondhand market up in a place called Dalesford near about 100k outside Melbourne. And I was looking around for various things and I found a copy of a Tony Curtis movie for $5 on DVD. Because yes, DVDs are now turning up in antique markets. And it was The Prince Who Was a Thief starring Tony Curtis and Piper Laurie. And that's the one that makes fun of Tony Curtis's accent, you know, yonder lies the castle of my father, the caliph kind of thing. But it's a little bit fun. It's one of those Arabian Nights adventures. It's in some very nice Technicolor. It's got some really kick-ass supporting actors. Jeff Corey's in there and Everett Sloan playing his stepfather or his adopted father. The Tony Curtis characters anyway. But, it's not really fantastically wonderful, but it's got a few little bits and pieces that are a bit cool. And it wasn't a waste of time to watch it. It was just one of those fun kind of 1950s programmers of the time that Universal did. But that's about all I've been watching. I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're doing this, of course, in chronological order as usual. And I'm going to talk about the 1955 drama Rebel Without a Cause, directed by Nicholas Ray, starring James Dean, Natalie Wood, and Sal Mineo.
You know what kind of drunken brawls those parties turn into? It's no place for kids.
A minute ago, you said you didn't care if he drinks.
He said a little drink.
You're tearing me apart!
What?
You say one thing, he says another, and everybody changes back again!
Girls don't love their father. Since when? Since I got to be 16?
Stop that!
I love you, Jim. I really mean it.
No, I don't want you to go to the police. There were other people. Why should you be the only one involved?
But I am involved. We are all involved. Mom, a kid was killed tonight.
This is all going too fast
for
me.
You better give me something. You better give me something fast.
Jimmy, you're very young. A foolish decision now could wreck your whole life. In 10 years, you'll never know this even happened.
Dad, answer her.
You want to kill your own father? Gary!
Okay, so Rebel Without a Cause is a 1955 American movie directed by Nicholas Ray and starring James Dean, Natalie Wood, Sal Mineo, Ann Doran, Jim Backus, Edward Platt, and a whole bunch of other people. Dennis Hopper, Nick Adams, you can just roll them on and on. Basically, this movie was kind of groundbreaking in a number of ways because it took the concerns of teenagers seriously. Before that, we had all that Andy Hardy shit in the 30s and 40s, and people post-puberty but before adulthood really weren't given a voice, and there wasn't a nuanced discussion about their needs and the way they fit into a kind of post-World War II world. But this movie does that. This movie really does kind of try to address those issues. And it also criticizes the psychology of parenting as it was at the time, which is quite an important thing. It starts out in a police station where the three protagonists, Jim, played by James Dean, has been arrested for common drunkenness, which is one of those kind of terms they used at the time. Natalie Wood, playing Judy, has been arrested too because she was out after curfew and she had bright lipstick on and the coppers thought she might have been a streetwalker. And strange enough of all, the third character, Plato, played by Sal Mineo, was arrested for shooting a litter of puppies with his father's pistol, which is very disturbing. It really is. Peter would definitely not enjoy this movie a lot. But we also see the kids, and they are teenage kids, they're still in high school, being picked up by their parents. Now, Jim Stark's parents are Frank, played by Jim Backus, and Anne Doran's character, Carol. Now, it's pretty obvious right from the start that they have a very dysfunctional relationship, and I would say an abusive relationship. Frank is in an abusive relationship with Carol, and she is the abuser, which is kind of an unusual thing to see in this kind of a movie and at this time in movies. And, of course, Jim's grandmother, Mrs. Stark, played by Virginia Brissac, is there, and she sides with Carol in all things. So the men in the family are kind of marginalized in a way in the Stark family. Now, I'm not saying that men have to rule a family at all, but the way that Frank in particular reacts and the way he is portrayed in the family unit, he's being taken advantage of, and he's basically in an abusive relationship with his wife. But there's no two ways about that, which makes it kind of interesting from our point of view, where we can see these things. Now, as teenagers do, Jim knows this, and Jim wants his father to take a stand and to show him and give him some guidance in how to be a man and how to be an adult as well and how to take responsibility, because nobody in that family is taking responsibility for anything, and Jim, being aware of this, just doesn't have a direction, doesn't know what to do. I'm not saying that everything he does is not his fault, because that's not the case. He does make decisions that are a very big negative impact on his life. And that leads to, of course, the conclusion and the somewhat tragic conclusion of the movie. Then we have the Natalie Wood character, who's got a kind of different thing. Judy's got a different thing. Judy is at puberty and become an attractive woman, and her father rejects affection to her. There's a scene which is shown in that trailer I did at the start where she attempts to kiss her father on the cheek because she's 16, and he slaps her on the face. Now, that's a devastating scene for a couple of reasons, one of which is the father's played by one of the most innocuous actors in Hollywood at the time, William Hopper, who was the son of the gossip columnist Hedda Hopper, and who went on to play one of the assistants in the Perry Mason TV series with Raymond Burr. But the fact that he slaps her on the face when she dares to show him some affection is really, really icky, because it's obvious that he's fighting off some kind of incestuous feelings towards his daughter, or he's scared that people will think he has them. But either way, he's definitely not dealing with the fact that his daughter is going through changes in her life and changes in her appearance, which he just simply can't deal with. And again, that's pretty fucked up. Then you have Sal Mineo's Plato, who is looked after by the family maid. The family don't actually live with him in the big house, and the maid, played by an actress called Marietta Canty, a woman of colour, is the person who comes down to bail Plato out. Now, Plato, for me, is one of the most interesting characters in this, because basically he's a teenage gay character, which is something we haven't seen in movies before. In fact, the screenwriter for this it was actually based on a very kind of scientific tome called Rebel Without a Cause and something else, but the movie has nothing to do with that original tome. But Stuart Stern, one of the screenwriters, has said, if you look at the documentary The Celluloid Closet, Stuart Stern has said that what he would do is play Plato more strongly coded as gay if he were to do it again, because he believes that this is important. Now, there's a whole bunch of stuff which, as the three teenagers kind of brush against each other and start forming friendships, there's a whole bunch of stuff which does strongly suggest that Plato is gay. For a start, in his school locker, he's got a picture of Alan Ladd. Now, whereas most people, straight kids, might have had Mamie Van Doren or something like that, he's got a picture of Alan Ladd, and he looks at it quite longingly. And there's a clear indication in the movie that Plato is very much in love with Jim, but just doesn't know how to express it. And he's got the uncertainties, of course, that young gay men have when they do become infatuated with people, on whether that attraction is reciprocal or not. And, of course, everybody goes through that to a certain level. But with gay people, you've got that extra level of, is that person of the same orientation as I am? Salminia does a nice job of playing. In fact, he won a Best Supporting Actor Academy Award for the role. And his character is quite sad. I mean, shooting puppies is probably not the best thing to do. It's not the best way to express your angst and anger and uncertainty about your identity is to shoot puppies. So I don't recommend that to anybody. But Plato actually has an interesting conversation too with Judy about Jim, where he fantasizes and projects about Jim, saying he likes to be called Jamie and that he's going to teach Plato how to hunt and fish and all those masculine kind of pursuits. There's a kind of sadness and a little bit of delusion in Plato as a character there, which is kind of really touching and something for this kind of movie and at this time. It's an incredible thing to have a character that is so very obviously gay. And in fact, Salminio himself was gay, and he was one of the first actors in Hollywood to come out as gay in the 1960s, which may have had a negative effect on his career. I think he was a good actor. I've seen him in a number of things where he was very good. He played Gene Krupa in the Gene Krupa story. He did some good supporting roles. He played a nice psychopath in a movie called Who Killed Teddy Bear. He was very well regarded on the stage as well. He did some plays like Fortune in Men's Eyes, and he was actually starring in a play in Los Angeles called P.S. Your Cat Is Dead. At the time he was killed, he was in a lane behind the apartment building where he lived, and he was stabbed in the chest a number of times by an assailant, who took about 10 years to find out who the guy was. But he was killed basically in his backyard, in a sense, in about 1976, I think it was. So all of the stars of this movie died early. Of course, James Dean was dead by the time the film was released in that car crash with his Porsche Spyder. And Natalie Wood, of course, died just around the time she was making Brainstorm in 1981, somewhere like that. So all of them didn't live to a ripe old age, but it would have been an interesting world if they had. In fact, a very fine writer I know called Jack Dann has written a book called Rebel, which I've actually got up on my shelf here, which is an alternate universe story about James Dean surviving that car crash and how he would have gone on to do other things. It's a really great book if you can find a copy of it. In fact, there's a new edition being released very soon. So if you type in Jack Dann, D-A-N-N, and James Dean, maybe, and you'll see that. It's called The Rebel, sorry, my apologies. The Rebel. It's a great book. I've read it myself. In fact, I've got an autographed copy of it up on the shelf there. I just had to look to confirm the title. But the interesting thing about Jack Dann writing a novel about James Dean is that for a time in the 1960s, Jack was an assistant to Nicholas Ray. So he had the inside story on a whole bunch of stuff there, which is kind of cool and kind of interesting as well. And the alternate history of Hollywood that The Rebel shows is quite interesting. But I'm digressing a little bit here. But what I'm essentially saying is this movie kicks ass. It's an interesting one, and it shows a change in the way teenagers were perceived. I mean, the interesting thing is historically, young people have gotten a really rotten run of things. Being young means that older people who, for reasons of envy or for reasons of wanting to keep social control and social power and things like that, basically put you down. There's no two ways about it. I mean, people are people, but teenagers, it's okay to vilify young people because they don't know anything. And that's been going on for as long as we've had ways of putting our thoughts into a permanent medium. It's on clay tablets, in Roman ruins, it's in classical writing. The Romans and the Greeks complain about the young generation. We do it all the time, and maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we've got to understand that people are going to fuck up when they're young, and people are going to make mistakes, and what we need to do as a society is to help them navigate their way through that and find ways for them not to be exploited while they are navigating their way towards adulthood. Now, we could always have a digression again talking about things like ISIS recruitments, which recruit young, disaffected men to travel to the Middle East to join the Daesh organization over there. If we alienate young people, it will come back and bite us. And that's one of the things this movie is saying. Now, Jim Stark's an interesting character. He's intelligent. He's got a good sense of humor. Now, there's some interplay between him and Plato. And also, I keep forgetting the female character's name. This is horrible. Judy. It's a very generic name. I better write that down. Judy. There's some interplay between that. Well, you should see Jim has a sly sense of humor. In fact, he does a Mr. Magoo impression while he's playing around with them, which is kind of cool too, because Jim Backus taught him how to do it. Jim Backus, of course, having been the voice of Mr. Magoo in the cartoons. And the casting of Jim Backus too, I love that. I love people who start out as comedy actors doing dramatic roles and doing them well. And Jim Backus does do that. He strips away all of the artifice and all of the mugging and all of the funny voices and things like that. And he is very good playing Jim Stark's father, Frank. And I like him for that. This is one of my theories, and it's not a universal verity, but it's something you notice, that comedians, when they do serious roles, are fucking good at it. I haven't really seen one where they weren't at least interesting. But, of course, some serious actors aren't very good at doing comedy, but people who are known mostly for being funny can occasionally really have lightning in a bottle when it comes to doing a dramatic role. You can see any number of cases of it. I mean, you've got Jerry Lewis and King of Comedy, all of that kind of stuff. Comedy actors are great. Jim Backus started out being a radio announcer and did funny voices on the radio. And there's an extra on the DVD of Rebel Without a Cause I've got where Gig Young, as a studio promotion thing, interviews Jim Backus. And Jim Backus kind of steers away from the questions about him doing a serious role and kind of goes back to what he knows, which is mugging and playing broad comic characters and things like that. He tends to do that. In fact, it's a little bit of a shame because I like Jim Backus as a serious actor. I think he really had possibilities there, but of course the opportunities weren't there. And even late in the Hollywood studio system, you don't really get an opportunity to be what you want to be. You get stereotyped. You get put into a certain box. And that's a shame because I think he had chops as a serious actor. The other person in there that's really interesting and who we know from much, much lighter material, of course, is Edward Platt, who played the chief in Get Smart in the 1960s. Edward Platt's really good as Ray Fremick, who's a kind of social worker cop, in a sense, who talks to Jim and offers some assistance and is a voice of adult reason there and knows the shit the kid's going through and offers him an opportunity. Of course, there's a tragic thing where he's not available when he's most needed because he's off doing other things. And that's I liked Ed Platt in this as well because, again, he's a serious actor who ended up playing straight man to a comedian for a long time, and that stereotyped him to a certain extent. But in this movie, he is the voice of reason and the voice of sanity among adults, whereas most of the other adults in the movie really aren't, kind of, haven't got all of their ducks lined up. They're fucked up for various reasons, particularly the William Hopper character, and of course Frank and Carol Stark, and of course Plato's parents aren't even there. There's a book about the making of this film called Live Fast, Die Young. I've talked about it once or twice before in the podcast. The Wild Ride of Making Rebel Without a Cause by Lawrence Freshella and Al Weasel, which I've read, and it's well documented and it's really interesting, and it goes into the history of the actors and the history of the production. There's much, much too much about it to talk about in this podcast, unless you wanted to go 4 or 5 hours. But I'll give you some of the gossip and some of the high points. First off, just before the making of this film, and I've talked about this bit of gossip before, but I love it, so I'm going to talk about it one more time. And that is that Nicholas Ray was married to Gloria Graham, who was in The Bad and the Beautiful and In a Lonely Place and a few other movies. A really great actress. So he was married to her at the time, and he had a teenage son from a previous marriage. So one day Nicholas Ray comes home and finds Gloria Graham in bed with his teenage son. That ended the marriage, and she later on married the son, which, you know, go figure that. So Nicholas Ray was kind of in a slightly bad way when he started making this movie. And one of the things he did was he had an affair with Natalie Wood, who was 18 at the time. Now, Natalie Wood was known to be sexually active at that age. In fact, she was also sleeping with Dennis Hopper and had been known. She grew up in Hollywood. She was a child actor and was known to be a bit of a wild child at the time. Now, I'm not making any judgments about that. I don't know whether it's an issue of abuse in Hollywood that caused her to be that, or she was just inclined towards it. But one way or the other, she was active there and had an affair with Nicholas Ray during the making of the film. And she was also good buddies with James Dean as well. There wasn't a relationship there, but they were friends and they got on very well together, and Sal Mineo got on well with both of them. James Dean, there's an argument about whether he was bisexual or not. I don't know enough to say one way or the other, but I know because he was in the New York theatre before he went to Hollywood, he was comfortable with his own sexuality, whatever that was. And with, you know, there are people who make all sorts of rumours about James Dean's sexuality, that he liked to have cigarettes stomped out on him and like to be shit on. There's all that kind of rumour around. I don't know enough to know that. But I do know that he was comfortable enough with whatever his sexuality was, that he was comfortable with Sal Mineo's one. And the sensitivity, I mean, it's fairly obvious watching the film closely that Jim knows that Plato is infatuated with him. And he treats that gently and with respect. He doesn't go into a homosexual panic or anything like that. He's kind of gentle and caring. And this is an unusual thing. You've got to remember, this is the 1950s. This is like big, brawny, hairy-chested 1950s Hollywood. And yet, you've got this sensitive portrayal of a teenage guy who's obviously heterosexual. I mean, Jim and Judy do have it hot and heavy. But he's comfortable enough with who he is and his moral compass after a certain incident occurs in the movie that he can be comfortable having Plato as a friend and having indulging Plato's eccentricities without giving him false hope of any kind of relationship in those terms. But yeah, I like that. I mean, it's one of those movies for that reason that plays well in the 21st century. There are tropes and ways that things occur in this movie that play well to an audience in the 21st century. And that's kind of rare. I've talked about a few movies lately where time has not been kind to them. Revenge of the Nerds is basically about sex offenders. All the nerds basically do things that transgress everything we know to be right. They treat women badly. They commit sex crimes, in a sense. If you rewatch Revenge of the Nerds, you're going to be sorely disappointed. And of course, The Party has got that racism in layered into it because of the brown face in it. But Rebel Without a Cause is different. Rebel Without a Cause has a sanity to it and a wisdom about it that these other movies don't have. And for that reason, it plays well. And it's probably one of the reasons why it has retained its popularity over time. Now, I'm going to start something in the podcast that I haven't done before, and I'm going to see how it plays. It's something I'm going to call standout scenes. What are the standout scenes in the movie? What are the bits to watch for, and what are the bits that are really cool? And there are a few of them in Rebel Without a Cause. Of course, there's a chicky run where the gang led by Buzz, played by Corey Allen, basically dare Jim to do a chicky run with them, which is they steal a couple of cars. Buzz and Jim get in one of the cars each, and they run them out a cliff, and the last one to jump out wins before the car careers over the cliff. And the chicky run doesn't end well, we all know that, but that's an interesting scene there as well, and it shows one view of how men should be and how guys should be, which ends up tragically wrong. Giving in to, you know, Jim's got this thing about being called chicken, and he'll react instinctively to it up to a certain point in the film. And that is the point at which Jim suddenly finds his moral compass. And there's some scenes which are played out a little bit in the trailer where he's talking to his parents about going to the police about having been involved in a chicky run where somebody has died. And his parents are reluctant to let him go because they don't want him to ruin his life, where he wants to take responsibility for his actions. He wants to man up and be honest with them. And this, of course, leads to further tragedy as well, because he goes to the police station and he wants to have a chat with Ray Frank, the Edward Platt character, to kind of talk it out and to confess. And Ray's not available, so he leaves the police station, but he's seen by one of the gang who think that he's there. He's already gone stool pigeon and told the cops what happened. And that leads to further tragedy down along the line. But it's interesting too, because he does find his moral compass and he does try to protect the people he cares about, particularly, of course, Plato and Judy. And that's one of the standout scenes, is the chicky run. I like that a lot. It's got a certain visceral energy to it, kind of like any number of car racing scenes in 1950s cinema, but it ends tragically and it shows that that's a fucking stupid thing to do. That's one of them. The other one is in the planetarium at Griffith Park. The movie ends at the planetarium at Griffith Park. But the kids are, the school kids are all in there watching a planetarium display. And the guy running it, played by a character actor who had an incredibly long career, Ian Wolfe, basically tells them that eventually the Earth will be destroyed by the sun and nothing lasts forever and that there's a finite time for everything in the universe. And this, of course, fucks up the kids a lot. It tells them that nothing's worthwhile. It kind of leads them in a nihilistic direction. Doesn't matter what you do, eventually the world's going to blow up. And that's kind of done in an interesting way. And it shows how impressionable kids can be. And they can be. You see the, something when you're looking around for something, you see something bright and wow, even if it is a negative thing, you can be influenced by that. And I like that scene as well. I also liked the bit in the, dried up swimming pool. And I found out that that's actually the same swimming pool that William Holden is face down in Sunset Boulevard, which is kind of cool. I always like movies that make these links between things. But I like the playfulness of the kids when they're allowed to be kids, when they're wandering around the deserted mansion and just kind of finding out who they are and learning who each other are and building the friendship between the characters. I like that bit as well. That kind of works for me, and it's nice, and it's sweet, and there's an innocence about that, which is really cool as well. And I like the climax as well. I like the fact that Jim tries to take responsibility, and Jim does try to man up with things and take steps that he thinks are going to help him, Judy, and the increasingly fucked up Plato at the end. But it doesn't turn out that way. But it's not his responsibility. He's not the reason why that occurs. In fact, nobody is, apart from Plato being off the rails and Plato being quite clearly a very disturbed young man. There's nobody else whose actions there are really to blame. The cops do what they have to in the circumstances. Jim and Judy try to stop Plato and work with it, and Jim takes steps to try to stop Plato from causing further damage, but it doesn't turn out that way. And there's a sad bit right at the end there too, where the maid who's been raising Plato is left standing by herself as all the cop cars and things pull away. I think that's an interesting thing to do. It's not overplayed, but Marietta Canty plays it really well. And Nicholas Ray does leave that there as a coda. It's not overemphasized, but I think it's there and I think it is important. But just to wrap up Rebel Without a Cause, it's a great movie. It's one of those ones that you enjoy and you understand why the hype was so big, and you understand why James Dean was perceived as a fantastic actor. He only ever made the movie because Giant, the production of Giant was delayed because Elizabeth Taylor got pregnant. And there was a space there when he could do it. And there were some other casting choices that would have really fucked up the film. Judy was going to be played by Debbie Reynolds at one stage, but that never occurred, fortunately. I'm not sure Debbie Reynolds had the range as an actor to play the role well. But just to wind it all up, I think that it's a movie that does show changes in society that have been echoing down through the years since then. I mean, this movie is 60 years old. And yet, it had a sympathetic portrayal of a gay character. It admitted that teenagers had sexual feelings. It did question certain kinds of parenting, and you know, parents aren't always right. And that was one of the first times in Hollywood cinema where that occurred too. Parents were kind of the font of all wisdom in a lot of mainstream Hollywood cinema before this. But at this point, that was starting to be questioned, and it was important that it did. And it showed James Dean at the peak of his abilities, and the fact that his death was a great loss to cinema. They could just imagine James Dean working in the 1960s. Of course, Jack Dan's book, The Rebel, shows what that might have been like. But yeah, he was a fine actor. I think that one of the things that his death did as well, which has kind of led on to other things since then, is that mass public grieving about his death. It was the first time since maybe Rudolph Valentino where that really occurred, and there was that kind of public tragedy, and people identified so much with the actor that the loss of the family became their loss as well. And I've got mixed feelings about that kind of overreaction to celebrity death. I really think that you need to pull back from that and recognize the good work they did, but that you didn't really know them. And being incredibly sad and over the top about the death of somebody you never met and somebody with whom you don't have any real relationship is problematic in our time. And of course, it was in that time as well. It was at the death of Rudolph Valentino and all of that kind of stuff. But the movie is a good film. It was originally going to be filmed in black and white, but they did decide to go in color. And I think that's a good choice too, because it let them make some changes to the costuming, particularly James Dean's red jacket and t-shirt. T-shirt sales skyrocketed after this movie came out, which goes to show you how a choice in a wardrobe at a Hollywood studio, in this case Warner Brothers, can have a profound effect on the way people dress over many, many, many subsequent years. But anyway, I'm going to wrap that up there and take a break. And when I get back, we're going to talk about a very different and very darker movie in some ways, The Parallax View from 1974.
Yes, Lee, how are you?
Senator Carroll, just fine, thank you. Welcome to our city. Since the assassination, six of these people have died in some kind of an accident.
There is no evidence of a conspiracy.
These people were killed. And whoever killed them is going to try to kill me. Austin thinks that maybe we all saw something up there.
We're in the business of reporting the news, not creating it. You've been asking questions about me and things you know nothing about.
What I know is I need a good alias and I need a good ID.
Who are you?
You know, there for a moment, I thought you were a man.
My life is in danger just being here.
But whoever's behind this is in the business of recruiting assassins. I think I got some of their entrance exams.
Congratulations, Richard. You had some very interesting scores on the first series of tests for Parallax.
You know, your tests suggest that you have remarkable talents.
In a risk situation, I believe you'll go right down the line.
See, the very quality that gets you in trouble is what makes you potentially invaluable.
We're prepared to offer you the most lucrative and rewarding work of your life.
There will be no questions.
The Parallax View is a 1974 conspiracy thriller. Directed by Alan J. Pakula and starring Warren Beatty, Hume Cronin, William Daniels, Paula Prentice. The screenplay was based on a novel by Lauren Singer, which I've got a copy of, but I haven't read in a long time. But the screenplay is by David Gilyar, Lorenzo Semple Jr., and Robert Towne, who did a lot of rewrites with Warren Beatty at the time and got into a lot of shit for it because people thought that he was crossing the picket line on a writer's strike that was going on at the time, but he'd actually completed the work before the writer's strike started. But leaving that aside, it's a great conspiracy theory. It's 102 minutes, but it travels along very fast. Pretty much the story is this. A TV newswoman, Lee Carter, played by Paula Prentice, is one of many witnesses to the public assassination of a presidential candidate, Senator Charles Carroll, on the top of the Seattle Space Needle. A waiter armed with a revolver is chased but falls to his death. Meanwhile, a second waiter, also armed, leaves the crime scene unnoticed. A congressional special committee determines that the assassination was the work of a lone gunman. 3 years later, Lee Carter visits her former boyfriend and colleague, newspaper reporter Joe Frady, played by Warren Beatty. I'm reading this from Wikipedia. Lee tells Frady that she feels there's more to the assassination than was reported at the time. 6 of the witnesses to Carroll's assassination have since died, so she fears that she'll be next. Frady does not take her seriously, but that then leads him on to the story. And he liaises with his editor, played really nicely by Hume Cronin. The editor's name is Bill Rintles. And he basically investigates the cover-up on this and discovers that the group behind the assassination of the presidential candidate is a company, not a political party or a political organization or a bunch of political people. It's a corporation called the Parallax Corporation, which trains and hires out assassins to anybody who can pay them. Now, this is, people have called it part of Pakula's paranoia trilogy. The first film in that was Klute in 1971, and the second one was this movie, of course, and then the third one being All the President's Men in 1976. They're not really a trilogy in any meaningful sense. He just did 3 different political paranoia movies. People like grouping things together so they can make neat little trilogies out of them, even when that doesn't necessarily happen. Now, you've got to remember the political context that this movie was made in. 1974... the previous decade and a bit had been pretty shitty for American politics, particularly when it comes to assassinations. It started off, of course, with Kennedy and all of the paranoia about the Kennedy assassination and whether it was just Oswald and the grassy knoll and all that kind of stuff. So that was the start of it. Then, of course, you got the Robert Kennedy assassination in 1968, and you've got Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination in the same year. So there's and there were also other attempts at political assassinations. There was the attempts by a couple of the Manson gang people, Squeaky Froman, that to kill Gerald Ford. So that political paranoia and the sense of political cover-up, and also the starting to come into and approaching and working around to Watergate, which is another big one, which of course was the theme for All the President's Men. So there was a growing sense, with the Vietnam War going on in parallel to this, that the political process in America was fucked up and was being influenced by what was then called the military-industrial complex. And so it's in this kind of environment that this nice little political thriller comes along, and it is a choice little piece of work. It really does. It's not the best political thriller movie in the world. You could always have the argument that The Conversation, Francis Ford Coppola's movie, is in some ways a lot better than it. But this movie does have some really interesting and really well thought out pieces to it, which I like a lot. One of the things I really like about the movie too is the music by Michael Small, which I'm going to play underneath me talking for the next 2 minutes or so, so you can kind of get the feel for it. It really is a nice little conspiracy theory movie kind of theme. The other thing is something that I noticed for the first, I've watched this movie I think 3 times, and one of the things I've really noticed about the film is the cinematography by Gordon Willis. He used anamorphic lenses with long lenses, unconventional framing and shallow focus, as it says here in Wikipedia. But the sense I got during the whole movie, which is really great and which I really love, and which adds to the paranoia and the sense of menace about the movie, is pretty much all of the movie is shot as if you're secretly watching the action. You're an observer, a person observing. So there are a lot of things that are shot through windows. There are a lot of things from unusual angles. You could be someone sitting in a bar during the bar scenes. You could be somebody sitting on a hill watching scenes. There's a lot of stuff done in long shot, and a lot of stuff done almost point of view from somebody who might be watching Joseph Frady as he investigates the goings-on of the Parallax Corporation, and leading from the assassination of the senator who's about to run for president. And the whole movie's like that. It builds up a really nice sense of menace about it and brings up, makes the audience almost one of the conspirators in a weird kind of way. There are bits which couldn't have a real person there, even if there was somebody watching. There are bits of it which don't allow a real person to be watching it, but the audience then becomes that person. And it really does do a nice job. And there's some surprising things about this film in that sense as well. There are characters who are introduced who you think are going to be there for the long term, and you think that a movie's going to progress along a certain path with that character, but that doesn't happen. And that's a little bit of a shock. That happens a couple of times during the movie. There's a couple of unexpected bits of violence which happen really interestingly and are intelligently framed and intelligently handled. I like that movie for this movie for that reason. It really does allow you to soak up the paranoia of the situation. I like the Space Needle too. I've been to the Space Needle in Seattle, so any movie that does a kind of action scene in the Space Needle, I go, oh yeah, I've been there, which is something Australians do because we haven't been to a lot of movie locations in a sense. A couple of other interesting things about the film, Joseph Frady, and Frady, of course, is an interesting name to give a character in a conspiracy theory movie because he's a little bit afraid. He's not a very good journalist in a sense. He's not Woodward and Bernstein. He's a second-rate journalist. He's fucked up. He's had a problem with alcohol and doesn't drink anymore. But he's a flawed character. He's a bit of a smug prick as well, which is kind of... He's ethically dubious. He's irresponsible. He's an unreliable person in a sense. But he is quite intelligent also. In fact, there are a couple of bits where he saves his life by thinking through a problem. There's a bit where he's on an aeroplane traveling east from Los Angeles, and he suddenly realizes that there's a bomb on the plane, and what he needs to do in order to get the plane to turn around is quite interesting. He makes one choice and then decides that's not going to work and that's going to cause more trouble than it's worth. And then he finds another way of getting the plane to turn back. So that's kind of well done too, and there's a certain tension built up in that because we don't know quite why he's doing it at the time. It's only later that we find out that there was a bomb on the plane, and even that's done off screen, which is kind of cool. There's another scene too where he's investigating another death from one of the witnesses of the assassination, and he's shown the place where the man drowned by a local sheriff. And there's a really nice action scene in there too, which plays off against an enormous dam which is released, doing a water release and flooding the bit of the valley near them, which I kind of like. It's beautifully shot. Mostly, there's not too many close-ups in that scene, but it's shot really nicely, and it's one of my favourite bits in it. That's one of the standout scenes in the movie as well. There's also a scene with Anthony Zerbe, an interesting character actor, playing the computer game Pong with a chimpanzee, which came totally out of left field. It's in a science lab where they're studying psychology. And there's Anthony Zerbe with a beard playing Pong with a chimpanzee. I love that bit because it's just so fucked up off the wall that even in the serious context of the reason why Joseph Frady is there to visit the science lab is still an amusing bit of stuff to happen there, which is, yeah, that's the kind of stuff I like in movies as well. I like Hume Cronyn. I always liked him as an actor. I think he's been a great actor since the 1940s all the way through to the end of his career and the end of his life. But in this one too, he plays the kind of newspaper editor you like. He dresses nicely. He's intelligent. He gives the Frady, even though he knows he's a dubious journalist, he's an ex-alcoholic, he's not entirely reliable, he gives him a little bit of leeway in order to let him follow through on this story. And he's worth your time in there too. I did like him. Paul Apprentice's character, Lee, is playing against type of Paul Apprentice, because she was always kind of played ditzy people and less serious roles. But in this one, you see her and you expect her to play the same kind of role she does. And in this instance, she doesn't. She was married for a long time to Richard Benjamin, the actor. And they did some things together, including a TV series called He and She. But she does do really well in a serious role. Again, somebody who's career tended to the light and the fluffy stuff, but in this case she took on a more serious role and did it very well. I like the fact that the movie jumps across the country too. It's not just in one location. It goes up to Seattle, it's down in Los Angeles, it's in a bunch of other places there. And there's one other scene that I probably should talk about, which is the montage. There's a montage which is used to program the assassins, and we see the whole of the montage. It runs about 6 minutes or so. And you can find it on YouTube if you like. Just type in the Parallax View montage in YouTube, and you're going to see the whole lot of it. And that's a beautifully put together montage of music and scenes of different things. There are pictures of people making love, and there's Thor, the Jack Kirby Thor from the comic books, and there's blood and guts and all sorts of things together. It's a crazy little montage that you think would stop the film, but sucks you in enormously. It's the best bit of mindfuck montage you're ever going to see in a movie. It really is lovely. It tells a lot. And the thing is, it doesn't stop the plot. It's not like something that's in there just to be a smarty-pants piece of filmmaking. It's incredibly important to understanding the breadth and the depth of knowledge that the Parallax Corporation has. You only see a couple of people representing the corporation, and they're mostly head kickers. But this scene shows you that the depths of the evil of this corporation in a really fascinating way. I love that montage. I'm not going to watch it too often because I may end up taking up a gun and shooting somebody. But it does fill in the gaps nicely, because you're seeing things mostly from entirely from Frady's viewpoint. You're only seeing little glimpses of the conspiracy and little glimpses of the Parallax Corporation. But this montage scene really does add to that, as indeed does the questionnaire. One of the reasons why Frady takes the questionnaire that he's given by the Parallax Corporation to Schwarzkopf, who's the Anthony Zerbe character, is he wants to know how to answer it so that he can pretend to be a potential assassin. And we do get to see a number of the questions on the screen from the Parallax Corporation. And that, just questions on a piece of paper and a mindfuck montage, give us the sense of the overwhelmingly powerful forces that Warren Beatty's character Joseph Frady is coming up against. And that's an interesting piece of storytelling as well. Yeah, a questionnaire and a montage tells us all we need to know in the context of the film about the bad guys. I mean, there's no long speeches by malevolent masterminds with white Persian cats on their laps. There's none of that shit. This kind of goes lateral and lets the audience grab the information rather than having it spoon-fed to them. And for that reason, it's a conspiracy theory movie that I really like. It's no secret that it's got a downbeat ending. It is, after all, a 1970s conspiracy thriller, but the ending is right, and there's a second assassination, which is filmed in a really interesting way, too. I'm not going to spoil that one for you, but the second assassination really is cool in the cinematic sense, but not cool because it's not cool to assassinate people. But just to wind it all up, Goodson conspiracy thriller. Go into it without looking up too much more about it than I've given you already, because there are some surprises and twists that are worth seeing cold. Warren Beatty's acting in it is adequate. It doesn't have to be anything more than he's the running man and he's the paranoid guy. He doesn't get to show his acting chops, which Warren Beatty, in spite of the fact that he's more known for the women he slept with when he was younger than for his acting chops, does a good job in it. The ensemble's good, but the cinematography and that montage really make the movie work, and the plot is one that you've got to pay attention to fully appreciate. It's not the kind of movie you can watch while you've got a laptop on your lap and you're updating YouTube. In fact, I wound back and put the laptop away to watch it. But that's about it for the Parallax View. I really think you should see it. It's a good paranoid thriller. Does the job well. And before I finish up, there is something I've got to talk about, which is very cool. Friend of the podcast, Everett Jones, sent me a link to a list of movies that Richard Nixon saw while he was in the White House from 1969 up until 1974, which is kind of cool, and he watched a lot of movies too. It's kind of like a letterboxed list for Richard Nixon in the White House. So thanks, everyone. I'm just going to go through the list. I actually printed it out. And there's a number of things that I've, a number of movies that I've talked about on Paleo Cinema Podcast. I'll just give you a few from each year just to give you an idea of what the kind of stuff he was watching was. In 1969, he watched Sand Pebbles. Now, this isn't all of the movies. This is just like a cherry-picked bit. The Sand Pebbles, Camelot, Bullet, Shalico with Sean Connery as a Western, of course. Support Your Local Sheriff, True Grit, Bridge on the River Kwai, West Side Story, The Guns of Navarone, The Longest Day, The Dirty Dozen, Roman Holiday, The Bridget Remagen, Cap Ballou, Marooned, and The End of the Year on the 31st of December with Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. That was Nixon in 1970. Sweet Charity, Paint Your Wagon, End of a Thousand Days, To Catch a Thief, Funny Girl, Hamlet, I think there may have been a Nicole Williamson one, The Caine Mutiny, The Cincinnati Kid, Top Carpy, talked about that in the podcast, Oklahoma, Ice Station Zebra, The Flower Drum Song, The Egg and I, which was the first Mara and Pa Kettle movie, Our Man in Havana, Bell, Book, and Candle. I've talked about that in a podcast before. The Sicilian Clan, which is a movie I want to do on the podcast when I can find a decent copy of it. The Treasure of Sierra Madre. Let's see. On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever, which is one of the few movies in which Jack Nicholson sings. Giant, The Americanization of Emily, The African Queen, Stagecoach, and he ended the year with The Pursuit of the Graf Spee. Now, in 1971, Citizen Kane, All About Eve, Spartacus, High Society, Gone with the Wind, Lawrence of Arabia, he watched it in two parts, Flight of the Phoenix, Rio Lobo, The List of Adrian Messenger, The High Commissioner, starring Rod Taylor, The Lady from Shanghai, Broken Lance, Shane, Breakfast at Tiffany's, The Quiet Man, They Might Be Giants, Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So we've got a bit of Sergio Leone in there. The Alamo, Cleopatra, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Red Tent, Clute. So he did see an Ellen J. Peculiar one. The Bad and the Beautiful, my all-time favourite movie. Strange Love of Martha Ivers, Brian Song, and he ended up with The Lonely Profession. 72, he watched The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly again, which is kind of cool. Paris When It Sizzles, which I've talked about in a podcast. Duel in the Sun, The Godfather. Diamonds Are Forever. Funeral in Berlin. Goldfinger. He went through a spy thing here. From Russia with Love. Prince and the Showgirl. Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. When Eight Bells Toll, another spy movie. The VIPs. Irma LaDuce, Gambit. So he was on a Shirley MacLaine kick there for a little bit. Bend in the River, Joe Kidd, Kelly's Hero, so we went on to a Clint Eastwood spree there a little bit. Let's see, Yankee Doodle Dandy, 30 Seconds from Tokyo, The King and I, South Pacific, there's a Rodgers and Hammerstein double bill there. Midnight Lace, which is a very bad Doris Day movie that I know of, The Great Escape, Young Winston, Rio Bravo, The Candidate, The Poseidon Adventure, Charade, The Lady Eve, which is a fantastic comedy, And he ended with the General Died at Dawn. 1973, Three Coins in a Fountain, Ride the High Country, Maltese Falcon, On the Waterfront, The Man Who Knew Too Much, Vertigo, Picnic, Sleuth, Kind Hearts and Coronets, Some Came Running, which is a great Vincente Minnelli movie with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin in it. The Quiet Man, Ocean's 11, he was on a bit of a Sinatra kick there. Inherit the Wind, which I've talked about in a podcast. A Hole in the Head. High Plains Drifter. He really liked the Clint Eastwood movies. Let's see what else we've got there. Separate Tables, another fine film I really should do on a podcast in the future. Alexander the Great, His Majesty O'Keefe, talked about that in Paleo Cinema 120. The Day of the Jackal, the original version, not the remake. Lawrence of Arabia again. The Blue Dahlia. Scorpio. Key Largo. Bang the Drum Slowly. Lonely of the Brave. Play Misty for Me. Zulu. Snows of Kilimanjaro. Live and Let Die. So we're still watching James Bond films. Travels with My Aunt. He ended the year with Jane Eyre. Last year, 1974, An Affair to Remember. Executive Action, which would have been an interesting film for a United States president to watch. The Long Goodbye, Charlie Varick. Must have been on a Joe Don Baker kick there. Harry in Your Pocket, James Coburn movie. Day of the Dolphin, Pony Express, The Amiga Man, Von Ryan's Express, Sunset Boulevard, Magnum Force, What's Up Doc, Rio Conchos, The Seven Ups, On the Beach, Holiday, Divorce Italian Style, The Big Sleep, and The Big Heat as a double bill. Man Without a Star, Double Indemnity, Two for a Seesaw, The Train Robbers, and Around the World in 80 Days. So I don't know whether these were curated for Richard Nixon, but there's some cool movies in there. Yeah, they tended towards the blokey films, but that's not necessarily a bad bunch of movies there. In fact, there are movies there I could pick out and do for the podcast. So it's a little bit sobering to think that the music, the movie tastes of Richard Nixon and me are not entirely dissimilar. But thanks anyway, Everett. That list, I'm going to put up on the show notes because it does make for interesting viewing, and it's probably a list from which you can pick out some pretty good films to watch if you so choose. By the way, we did get an email too, which is kind of cool, from Stephen Vale, who's also a new Patreon subscriber. I'm going to get in touch with you, Stephen, and we'll work out what your credit is going to be for the end credits and which movies you'd like me to do, because you do get the right to pick them. But Stephen sent me an email saying, "Your two podcasts. Terry, I've been enjoying your podcast for some months now and just recently bit the bullet to support. Not too much of a bullet, barely a pellet. Subscribed on iTunes. I mostly use Pocket Cast as my podcast consumption app of choice, but will subscribe via iTunes when I feel a podcast needs it and warrants it, as I do yours. And left a glowing 5-star review just now." I'm going to have to check out the review, haven't you? "I like the cut of your jib in your podcast. I mostly agree with you, and even when I don't, it always makes me think about it a second time. And quite often I've found some old gems that either I didn't know about or I forgot about. Plus, I like the background you get on the films if you choose. I'm getting into filmmaking myself as an uber-independent entrepreneurial filmmaker. This is kind of like a third or fourth career for me, but I'm going in full force. Just FYI, although I still use my title Rabbi, went to school for 10 years to earn it, I no longer function as a clergyman. I'm not dogmatic or doctrinal in any shape or form. And although I consider myself spiritual, it's much more firmly rooted in a Taoist Buddhist philosophy. The Bible for me is at its best a work of literature, perhaps even classic literature, but not a guide for my life. If anything, Neil Gaiman's Sandman, possibly my favourite work of literature of all time, is much more important to me for many reasons, too many to go into here. I had to go to a desert island and can only bring one body of work with me. It would either be Sandman or the collected works of Mark Twain. Essentially, I'm a philosopher. I'm not too big on beliefs or belief system. Belief is way overrated. For me, the term rabbi is more like a PhD title, more like a doctor. It's a title of honour amongst an ancient people of which I happen to belong, although ancestry but not through ancestry but not through religion. So to most people, I'm just simply Steve. The title is more of a stage name and a professional sobriquet. Just saying. I always look forward to your next episode and look forward to many episodes on both podcasts. By the way, if you haven't seen Ex Machina, and pardon me if you have seen it, I mentioned that and I forgot, highly recommend it. and a film that was highly recommended by the BBC 5 Live Film Crew podcast by Mark Kermode, is one I just watched on Netflix, recently done by a Persian-British-American woman filmmaker, Anna Lily Amirpour. A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, I also recommend. Both films have at least a slight feminist theme, and both are slightly or more than slightly creepy, and both are outstanding. One might even say that A Girl Walks Home is to vampire films as Ex Machina is to AI science fiction. Also, if you've not done so yet, the great Peter Weir's The Last Wave, and it's one you do like, I would love for you to tackle this one on one of your shows. If not, I have plenty of other suggestions, being 58 years old myself and a movie buff, REIT addict my whole life. You do a great job, brother. Thanks for doing it. Keep up the good work. Cheers, Steve. Thank you, Steve, and thank you for supporting the podcast, and I'm glad to that you're there. Yeah, it's interesting that you see Rabbi as a kind of professional name. It's interesting seeing how people, I mean, I don't have any belief myself, but it's interesting to see how people of some form of belief negotiate the 21st century with that belief. I find it a bit interesting, and I think I'm going to work in the next year or so being a bit more tolerant of things I don't understand, like religious belief. But yeah, Ex Machina is on my list to see, and A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, I'm going to see. In fact, I'll make a commitment to put them onto Martian Drive-In podcast. The Last Wave I saw it, I haven't seen it for a lot of years, but I should revisit it and do for a podcast, The Last Wave. I actually did see it when I was living in Sydney, and Sydney is where it's filmed and set. So I saw it in Sydney, and of course it's got those apocalyptic waves and the heavy rainfall and things like that. I saw it in the city CBD, not far from where certain scenes in the film were filmed. And I walked outside and it was pissing down raining. So that made the film even more evocative for me, the fact that what I saw in the film of Sydney was what I saw in the film, what I saw of Sydney when I left the film. But thanks, Steve. I really appreciate the support, both the Patreon support and the support from you watching this, listening to the podcast and putting the review in on iTunes. So I really appreciate both of those things. What I might do is, let me know if this is okay, and I might make you the spiritual advisor for the podcast, given that you do have the title of Rabbi. I'm very happy to accept that if you are. But anyway, that's about it for the podcast. I'm going to put up the end titles now and the end credits. Steve will be on there next time, and I will amend it so that Tim Leiby's title of New York Location Manager is also added to it. In the meantime, look after yourselves. Take care of each other. Watch good movies, and I will be back in 2 weeks with another podcast. I'm going to probably do a music podcast to fill the time when I'm traveling around Australia. But look after yourselves, and it's been a great lot of fun doing this podcast. I've really got back into the, I've got my energy levels back, and I'm really grooving on doing this. So take care, and I'll catch you later. Bye. And here are the podcast credits in the style of movie credits. And the way to get on the credits is to donate to the podcast via patreon.com/paleocinema. Okay, we have Tim the Mystery Credit. I haven't got the credit from Tim yet. We have Tammy the Donut Wrangler. Paul the Special Makeup Effects Director. Mark the Second Unit Director. Alyssa the Location Scout. Tansy the Foley Artist. Miss Jane, the Wardrobe Mistress, Christopher, the Gaffer, Chris, the Camera Operator, and we'll wait for the big crescendo in the music, which is Alberato del Gracioso by Ravel. Julia, the Casting Director, Elaine, the Scientific Advisor, Matt, the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Armin, the Key Grip, Jan, the Dialect Coach, Morris, the Music Director, Gary, the Prop Master, Claire, the Script Doctor, Grant, the Technicolor Consultant, Ian, the Caterer, Sarah, the Special Effects Technician, and Tom, the Focus Puller. Thank you very much to all of the people who support the podcast via the Patreon campaign. I'll catch you guys later.